Support for WPR comes from Viterbo University, dedicated to supporting the state's health with doctoral and master's degrees in nursing, counseling, nutrition, and more. Viterbo.edu/graduate.
Support for WPR comes from the Dram Corporation, based in Manitowoc, Wisconsin. Manufacturers of professional-grade handheld watering nozzles, sprinklers, and cutting tools. More information is at dramm.com.
Today's 100-year-olds have lived through World War I, the Great Depression, World War II, Y2K, so much more. What wisdom do they have that we can benefit from? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We will talk with a guest who will share with us what he learned from extensive interviews with Americans, centenarians. And we will welcome your questions and we'll welcome your experiences. Are you 100 years old or getting close? Do you know someone who is? What have you learned from the very old? What would you like to share with the very young? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is Steve Franklin, co-author of Celebrate 100, Centenarian Secrets to Success in Business and Life. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy. Thank you for having me on your show.
Well, thank you for joining us. What do you think, Steve Franklin, what are the chances we have someone who is 100 years old or older listening to us right now?
I hope you do. There's about 60,000 centenarians throughout the United States out of a population of 330 plus million. So my guess is there's a good number. Well, I know there's a good number in Wisconsin, but I don't know the exact state-by-state count, but I sure hope someone is.
And I'm sorry, how many did you say that we know of?
There's close to 60,000 centenarians in America. And by the way, it's the fastest-growing segment of our population. And they estimate there'd be, and again, nobody knows the exact number, but somewhere between a half million to a million of us, and I'll be one of them, in about 30 years. And so I hope you have some listening in today.
I sure do, too. I know one of our Facebook listeners did post that her aunt was going to be turning 102 in a couple of months. So are there more people living to be 100 now than ever before?
Yes, as far as we know. And I don't know how far back the research started where we started literally looking at with data, with census data on centenarians, but yes, we're pretty confident there's more than ever today. By the way, super centenarians, just so you'll know, because hopefully we may have a super centenarian listening in today, they are people 110 and over. And as far as we know, there's only about 70 of those, according to the Guinness Book of World Records, that are verified over 110 years young. So maybe we might have a super centenarian listening in today.
Well, I would love it. You know, I just occurred to me, just before going on the air with you, My parents have passed away, but I realized that my father, who passed away some years ago, would have turned 100 years old this year.
Isn't that great?
Yeah, you know, he was born in 1913, and boy, how many changes have taken place since the early 1900s? He saw so very much. Why did you and your co-author decide to focus on people who are 100 years old or older?
Well, the thing that got me started on this was I was sitting at, this was like 14 years ago, I was sitting at a breakfast one morning out in Colorado.
That doesn't sound good. It looks like we lost the connection with our guest, so we'll have to call him back. Sometimes that happens with telephones. So we will reestablish our contact with Steve Franklin, co-author of Celebrate 100, Centenarians' Secrets to Success in Business and Life. And we will welcome your questions for him, and we'll welcome your own experiences. Any chance there's anybody listening right now who at least knows someone who is 100 years old or older? How about 110? That would be amazing. Are you close to that? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We will talk about what we can learn from centenarians. And Grace in Lodi is with us. Hello, Grace.
Hi. Yes, I work at several different nursing homes in Wisconsin. And I notice when I talk to the centenarians, if they're not in dementia, but they're, you know, just there because they're frail, that really what they recollect the most is their childhood and what they learned from their parents. And it's funny when you're talking to somebody that age and they're saying, well, my mom taught me this and my dad taught me this. And when you think about how little a section of time that is that you spent with your parents, I mean, up to maybe 18 years old. And then there's the whole rest of those 80-some-odd years that they've lived. But yet their recollection seems to hone in on those childhood memories and what their father taught them or what they, you know, this is how it was in my household. This is what we had to do. You know, this is, it sets the whole pace for their 100 years, and I just find that fascinating because I'm in my 40s, and I don't really think about my childhood that way that much. I think about things I learned more so maybe in college or on the job, you
right.
know? But they seem to really come back to the roots of when they were probably younger than 18. You know, it seems like it's more around when they're like 10 years old. Is a really detailed focus for them.
Well, I'll ask our guest about that when we get him back on the line. I'm guessing that sometimes people who are, while you say that they don't have dementia, sometimes that long-term memory is stronger than the short-term memory. So those memories are even stronger.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering if you noticed at all, Grace, that the centenarians that you've dealt with are they bemoaning the state of the world today? Are they you know, concerned about where things are today as to where they were when they were, you know, when they were in their prime or growing up?
No, I can't say so. They seem to me more focused on the family and their current relationships and the people who have been in their life, their family members, and more. It's more what I've noticed, instead of being more in a world perspective, that it's more honed in closer to who they are and who their surrounding current family is and the state of that family, mm-hmm. how they're doing. So more relationship type issues.
Well, Grace, thank you very much for sharing your experience working with centenarians in nursing homes. And we are still trying to reestablish contact with Steve Franklin, co-author of Celebrate 100, talking about what we can learn from today's 100-year-olds. And Mary in Milwaukee is with us. And Mary, I understand you have a relative who is 100 years old.
Yes.
And who is it? Mary, are you there? Oh, what's going on? I don't know. All of a sudden, Mary's call dropped off as well. It was her great uncle turned 100 this year, and I understand that his secret was everything in moderation, which is sounds like good advice. Everything in moderation. All right, we have our guest back, Steve Franklin, co-author of Celebrate 100. Centenarian Secrets to Success in Business and Life. And what's the advice on getting good telephone lines, Steve Franklin?
Yeah, good. I'll have to ask the next centenarian I interview, which is going to be in a couple of days, that question. Apologies.
So, no, that's okay. You know, we just heard from a caller, and before I forget, she said that she deals with a lot of people who are 100 years old or older who are in nursing homes. She works in a nursing home.
Right.
And she says that they don't have Alzheimer's or severe dementia, but they seem to really want to talk about their childhoods and what
right.
their parents taught them. Any comment on that?
Yeah, it was, I discovered the same thing. And again, people have asked me, do they think our sample size is indicative of the entire 60,000 or so? And I said, I think so. You know, if you look at 500 people out of, 60,000, that's a pretty good sample size that's able to answer these kinds of questions. And a lot of the interviews we had were in their homes. Probably about a third of the people we interviewed still living in their homes, either by themselves or with a relative. And probably two-thirds in some kind of assisted living situation, and some in nursing homes. But yes, they love to tell, and really the thing that got me going on this, Joy, was they love to tell their stories. And I would ask them a lot of things about their childhood. Say, well, who taught you about, when you were a child, who taught you about money? What did you learn about money, saving money, spending money as a child? Tell me about work. Who influenced you early on as a child about work? And many of them would start out talking. One lady, I've got the names rolling around again in a minute. She said, when I was a kid, I picked cotton. And she said, one day I picked 300 pounds of cotton. She went on over and over about that. I picked 300 pounds of cotton that day and outpicked my older sister, my older brother, and all those wonderful things like that. So they love to share those stories of youth and growing up. And that's the thing I try to encourage people to do when I speak around the country. I say, look, they don't have to be a centenarian. Go out and capture the wisdom on tape, of people that are older than you. And I give them 100 questions, in the back of the book, from birth to centenarianship that they make it, of things to ask them about life, and capture it on tape, and then share it with your family, share it with your friends, and share it with the people around you, because they need to hear it. Repetition is the mother of all learning. And these people ask the right way, ask the right questions. They will go on and on about the stories of growing up, and they'll give you all in the world the advice that they have to offer about money and work and life in general. If you will just ask the questions, be patient, and let the camera roll.
I think that's a great idea. But what is it that we can really learn from, from someone who has lived for 100 years?
Well, let's take three categories. You want to take money, and then work, and then life?
No, I guess I'm thinking that, all right, 2013 is a whole new world than what it was in, 1913 or 1933. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So is there advice that applicable today?
Absolutely. Let's just talk about money. Money's been around for a lot longer than 1913. People today, one of the first questions I asked was this. I said, how well do you think the younger generation is doing today managing money? And by and large, they said awful. They said terrible. They're drowning in debt. They've got credit card debt. They buy things they can't afford because they just don't have the discipline to not buy it, and therefore they're in debt. And to them, debt was a nasty four-letter word. Like Catherine Donnell, I asked her, I said, you lived to be 107. I said, how did you make it through the Great Depression? She said, well, the three do's. And she said, people need to do the same thing today, the three do's. I said, what are the three do's? She said, you make do with what you got, you do over things that you got rather than go buy a new one, and you do without. You have the discipline to do without until you've got the money to buy things. And so one of the things that is very applicable today is if you're in debt, get out of debt. And if you don't have debt, stay out of debt. You'll wait till you have cash to pay for the things you want. I'm talking cars, refrigerators, televisions, furniture. Hardly any of them paid less than 20 or 30% down on their houses by the time they bought a house. So I think that's very, very applicable to the younger generation today, and that is stay out of debt, get out of debt, et cetera. So I don't know how anything could be more applicable. One of the questions I asked him, I said, during your entire lifetime, what's the best financial decision you ever made? Hoping that I would kind of get, a majority answer on that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all over the board. And what it was diversify your investments. I mean, they invested in stocks and bonds and mutual funds and real estate and you name it. They invested all over the place. In fact, in the book, I have a wonderful poem from Les Holt, 107. When I asked him that question, I said, well, Les, what's the best financial decision you made, and what advice would you give to young people today about investing? He said, let me think about that, and I'll send you something. And about a week later, I get a poem that covers the gamut.
Can you read it to us?
Pardon me?
Is it a long one? Can you read it to us?
Would you like me to read it? I wish I had him here to read it for you. But I'd love to read you the poem. I'm telling you, this is one wise poem. And by the way, he did it on a typewriter. I tell people, so you remember what a typewriter was? But I love you. You can read it.
Yes, please do. I don't. You can't hear me, I guess. But yes, please do.
Can you hear me? Okay. It's called Investing Today. This is Alesso 107. How best to invest today? You asked. Finding an answer is a difficult task. The task seemed quite easy in former years, and you did the job without shedding tears. And it seems most investor advisors could be trusted, but today, if you follow some, you are apt to get busted. So today, it seems best to put on your thinking cap or just settle down for a long winter nap. For many years past, the choice was cow pastures and farms. That is, if you didn't mind getting sunburned arms. Then many farmers gave up on their crops and moved into town and opened up a small shop. And then corporations, big and strong, offered their stocks and bonds to the throngs. Finally, vast mutual funds came to stay, and thousands of investors headed their way. More recently, ETFs came to the fore and offered investors more cash than before. Mortgages for many years offered a goodly feast. Then came subprime, that awful beast. CDs and T-bills gave some peace. Then interest on them came almost to cease. So now we seek something different and bold, and our thoughts turn quite naturally to gold, or in silver perhaps the real thing to own, or may it too cause us to moan. Chances are that eventually good times will prevail. So if one chooses to be too pessimistic, he is most likely to fail. It appears no one has a crystal ball. No one can make that magic call. So why not be most thankful for vibrant, good health, which, after all, is the very best form of wealth.
Aw, that's wonderful.
Isn't that really great?
Yeah, that is super great. And Lori puts it very simply. I was told by my great aunt that people need to save every penny they can. So they're...
Right. Let me tell you, are you still there?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, I want to make sure. Let me tell you a question to ask them. I said, what percentage of your gross income should you try and save? Now, not what did you personally do during your life, but now having lived a century, longer than a century, looking back on your life, what percentage of a person's gross income do you think they should try and save? And the absolute minimum, and by the way, most frequent answer I got on that was 10%. You know, save a minimum, absolute minimum 10%. But over a third of our centenarians said you ought to save 30 to 50%. And many of them did, and which is almost incomprehensible to the younger generation today. How in the world can you do it? But you can't, because they said over and over to me, Joy, Steve, it's not what you make. It's what you spend. And I remember one lady, she's a sweetheart. She said, I asked her the question, what percentage should you try and save? She said, you should try and save all of it. I said, well, you can't save all of it. You know, she said, well, you asked me what percentage you should try and save, but you should try and save all of it. But you make a dollar, you put 50 cents in the bank. And I said, did you do that during your lifetime? She said, absolutely. And at 103, I mean, she was quite well off. Never made a whole lot of money, but, you know, compound interest over 40, 50, 60 years, you don't have to save a lot each year for you to be well off then by the time you're 100.
We are talking with Steve Franklin. He is co-author of Celebrate 100, Centenarian Secrets to Success in Business and Life. Maybe we'll get some advice when it comes to work and business coming up. And we welcome your questions, and we welcome the advice that you might have if you're a centenarian or getting there, or if you have a loved one who is. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about living to be 100 years old or older, and the wisdom that today's centenarians have for the rest of us. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Our guest interviewed 500 American centenarians for his book, Celebrate 100. And we are talking about their advice and their secrets to success in business and life. And we're welcoming your questions, your comments about this. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. The book, Steve Franklin, is Secrets to Success in Business and Life. What else about business? What other advice do the centenarians have about work life?
Well, very, very important. And there's a lot of research, Joy, going on today about the correlation between the longer you work, the longer you live. And, of course, these studies are so longitudinal, they're all sort of in process still. But four or five key points that we gleaned from them about work was, number one, is I call it take this job and love it, as opposed to the old song, take this job and shove it, you may recall a few years ago. They love their work. I asked them the question, if you had your life to live over again, would you do something different? And the vast majority said, no, I loved what I did. And they did all kinds of different works. In fact, I even have in the book, you know, the A to Z's, things that they did to give people ideas of where to look for work. So they just loved what they did. And they said, you know, I asked them about that. I said, what advice would you give to the younger generation about work? They said, look, find something that you love to do and then give it all you got. I mean, I had comments like one fellow, he was a teacher, Don Johnson, still living up in Boston, said, you know, my work was like a work pill. It was like a health pill. Work was a health pill to me. I just loved it. Every day I got up and went to work, it was like a health pill. I just absolutely loved it. So most of them really enjoyed their work, and I encourage people to find work that they love. I encourage employers. I think this is important for the business side. Look. Make sure you do a good job interviewing people such that the jobs you have to offer, that you are going to match a person that can really love that job. Don't just get somebody that can do the job. You keep on interviewing until you find somebody that will love that job, and it's suited to their, you know, needs and wants, and therefore you're going to have a much better employee longer term, which leads to the second point, is work as long as you can. I tell everybody, I am really against mandatory retirement. I tell businesses, you need to cut out this craziness of mandatory retirement. I hope, Joy, you're doing your show when you're 110.
I do, too.
Okay? You know, because it's nuts. And I tell everybody, look, experience plus longevity equals an excellent workforce. Now, when somebody reaches, like in pilots, for instance, I mean, it's a great notion of making pilots quit at 60. They do okay, maybe you do checkups every 3 months rather than every 6 months to make sure they have all the capacity and skill set to fly planes. But I'd much rather have a 63 or 4-year-old fly my plane than a person just fresh out of out of flight school. And I don't mind having both. But the point being is that this idea of mandatory retirement at 60 or 65 is crazy. I had Walter Bruening worked till he was 99, world's oldest man, lived to be 114 and a half. And he was, again, if he worked for the railroad, loved working for the railroad 50 years, but they forced him to retire at age 67. And so he kept on working there in Great Falls. He went to work and worked local organizations. And at 99, he was real cute. He said, at 99, I decided I need to quit doing two things, Steve. He said, I need to quit working and quit smoking. I said, Walter, you smoked till you were 99? He said, yes, and I think quitting early has contributed to my longevity. He was a sport model, as I say. Dr. Lila Denmark, who lived to 114 plus, one of my super centenarians, she was a practicing pediatrician to 103. She was seeing children at 103. And by the way, you and I don't have the whooping cough today because she was on the research team that found the cure of the whooping cough.
Mm-hmm.
I had another centenarian down in Florida who was tutoring freshmen and sophomores in college in calculus. He had a PhD in calculus. And so at 101, he was driving over and tutoring students at 101 on calculus. A lot of people worked into their 80s and 90s. We had a number that retired at 65 or whatever, but they stayed active and busy, maybe not for pay work, but they have stayed active in various types of volunteer work. And again, the research that's going on right now suggests that. So we're out to tell everybody, work as long as you can. If you're 65 and they force you to retire, you go out and rehire somewhere.
Let me jump in because we have some callers who want to share some stories. Betty in Oak Creek is with us. Hello, Betty.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Well, I retired at 65 because my job was eliminated. But we've always been a savers, where we would save, you know, a certain, like maybe a few, even 5%. But the company I worked for had a 401k plan, and I maxed out on that because they matched. And so many of the other employees would say, oh, no, I can't afford that. I can't afford it. But when you don't see it, you don't really miss it. And you can pretty much you can manage it by not seeing the, all that money coming in and putting it toward your retirement. And today, my husband and I are 82 and I'm 78. We're not wealthy, but we aren't hurting either, and we, you know, are comfortable. And I think it's because we were savers. Thank you.
Well, thank you,
Betty,
very much.
If you're comfortable, you are wealthy. So good for
exactly.
you.
Exactly. And healthy.
And that's it. 401ks are the greatest investment you can make when you have a matching plan with an employer. And you can't make that. You can't find any other investment today that if a employer is going to match you, whatever they match you, there's no investment throwing off that kind of return with no risk, with absolutely zero risk. So I encourage people strongly that if they've got 401ks, any kind of matching plans, to do that. But good for you. And many, many, many of these centenarians were savers. Now, there were a few who said, gee, I wish I had saved more now. Had I known I was going to live this long, I would have.
Well, yeah, in fact, I thought that was interesting that I read that comment saying you should probably plan on living to be a very ripe old age and make sure you save accordingly.
The my favorite story and one of my favorite interviews was my girlfriend Lillian Cox. She was in Tallahassee, Florida. She's now living out in Houston with her daughter. And I said, Lillian, what's the best and worst financial decision you ever made? She said, well, the best financial decision I ever made was starting my own business. Made a lot of money, made a lot of friends, absolutely loved it. But the worst financial decision I ever made was selling that business at age 65. She said, my dad died in his 30s, my mom died in her 60s, and the oldest living relative in my family had been my sister, who died at 71. Nobody had lived past 71 in my family. So I thought I only had about 5 or 6 more years to go. So I sold my business, and she said, darling, you name it, I've been there. Traveled all over the world, first class with my friends and my family, but by the time I was about 71, I was broke, and I've been broke for over 30 years. And the takeaway I tell everybody from Lillian is, look, don't bet on not living to 100. Instead, plan on living to be 100, financially wise, you know, health wise, et cetera. That way, if you live to 100 plus, financially, you'll be comfortable, like Betty just said. If you check out a little early, your heirs will celebrate your success that you have left behind.
Yeah, so, Betty didn't say it, but she thought that by, you know, socking away enough money in her 401k, that having this comfortable retirement really also relieved her and her husband of a lot of stress and worry, and that's going to be good for their health too.
These people were masters of stress. One of the things I asked them was the secret. Why do you think you live so long? Because I didn't have much stress. Now, think about this, Joy. If you don't have any financial stress from a debt perspective in your life, you think how much less stress you're going to have. And we know, you know, we're studying, doing a lot of studies right now about stress and the impact on strokes and heart, you know, disease and all of that. But now these people, and you got to listen carefully to this. I said debt stress. These people went without for a lot of it. I mean, they went through the depression. They went without. One lady said it got down to be a Sunday evening, and all we had was 2 pieces of bread and some white Cairo syrup, and that was it until my husband got his paycheck on Monday. And so they didn't have a lot, but they didn't have debt. And so they weren't stressed out. They learned to make do with what they had. So I think that's a big, important thing, because I think the level of financial stress in our country right now for young people in particular, I'm a boomer. Boomers and all those behind us, the Echoes and I forget all the names. There just is a whole lot more debt and stress associated with that than these centenarians experienced.
Yeah. I do remember my parents who both lived through the Depression. It wasn't just, it certainly influenced their, you know, their savings ethic and their and their spending ethic too. It was just you just made do with what you had, and you didn't
yes.
you know, you didn't buy, you know, three TVs or three cars or whatever. And it was a different mindset, a different lifestyle.
That's correct. Like, I'm just using one tires. Everybody probably listening to this show has a car or a truck, and they rub tires. They just made them run longer. You know, during the Depression, they said, you know, we just made our tires. Yeah, a lot of times they even got smooth, so we went slower. Because, you know, I think a lot of people today, the trailer gets down to, what, a quarter of an inch, we go out and buy brand new tires. Well, you just make do with, you know, you go longer with stuff, you know, until you got the cash to pay for it. And they just made things stretch out. They wore clothes longer. They fixed things. You know, it's hard to fix a lot of things now because they're so technologically difficult to, but they fixed things rather than went out and buy a new one. Mm-hmm. And it is. It's a mindset. It really is a mindset. But that kind of mindset led to very little to no debt for most of them ever. Most of them had some mortgage debt, of course, along the way. And one of the greatest answers I got, I called it the twinkle factor in the book, but what's the best financial decision you ever made? And they said, paying off our mortgage, owning the farm, owning the house, having no debt. They would just twinkle, you know, when they said that. So one of the encouragements I have to younger people when I speak is, look, you get out of debt completely, including your mortgage, as soon as you can. And when you do, when you owe nobody anything, there's a psychological richness, if you will, that you just can't experience until you've experienced it. And I have.
Let's talk a little bit about what did the centenarians tell you, or why do you think they have managed to live so long?
Well, that's a great question. And the first question I was asked, did you ever think you lived to be 100? And all but about three said no, they didn't. Second thing I asked them was, what's the greatest thing about living to be 100? And I got lots of great answers to that. That's in the book. The third thing was, I said, okay, Joy, what's your secret to living to 100 plus? And we had no categories, and we just said, give us your answer. And then what we did is we got all the answers, and we categorized them. And the number one by far that came in was what we just labeled attitude. I mean, it's just a positive attitude about life. It's almost essential, I think, to success and longevity in life. I coined this phrase. I said, in meeting all these beautiful people, I said, there's two kinds of people. Two kinds of centenarians, and therefore two kinds of people. There's people that wake up in the morning and they say, good morning, God. And there's people that wake up in the morning and say, good God, morning. You know, it's all the attitude. And these people just marveled, at life. They were appreciative of life. They had no entitlement mentality, no blaming other people for the tough times they've had in life. They take full responsibility for it. They've learned to master stress, not sweat the big or the small things. They just have an attitude of gratitude that was inspiring, to me and Lynn both. I mean, it was just inspiring, and they have what we call a centenarian spirit about life. So by far, attitude, you know, was number one. The second thing that came in terms of, you know, responses was we call it healthy eating, not diet. I can't remember, to be honest with you, interviewing a single centenarian that was ever on it. In fact, I would ask this, Joy, have you ever been on a controlled diet, you know, or you bought these health foods that you're seeing through it? No. They ate what they wanted, but they ate in moderation. I would say a key word that categorizes most centenarians is moderation in everything, exercise, eating, reading, sleeping, everything. But so healthy eating, they ate what they want. Think about this. Like, they were probably the original organic food consumers.
Sure, they're getting it right out of the garden.
Yeah, because so many grew up in rural areas, and they had a garden, and this was interesting. The people that lived on the farms, you know, in rural areas, when the Depression hit, they were least impacted by the Depression than those who lived in cities. They said, well, yeah, we were aware of it, and we had to stretch things further and drive tires longer, and we didn't have as much to eat, not as much fuel to get, and things like that. But it really didn't impact them as near as much as the ones who grew up in the cities, in New York City, Boston, Washington, some other big places, where they did see some of the people jumping out of the buildings when the crash hit in 29, and people standing in line all day long to eat an apple, to get an apple to eat. They in the cities, they really experienced some big things like that. And then the third big thing for them, you know, is we call it faith, you know, belief in a higher power, God or a higher power, and a lot of them had a very strong faith. and belief in God. I had a lot of cute anecdotal comments about that. But very strong, you know. The fourth secret that was categorized in terms of frequency was just exercise and activity. Now, again, not going to the health clubs and have a regimented, you know, 5-day-a-week workout schedule or anything like that. Just walking, you know, climbing stairs, being active, working in a garden, doing stuff. They just were active, you know, and they just exercised. I did go with my girlfriend Helen Hannah. I asked her what was her favorite kind of exercise. She said, "Well, I go to water aerobics 3 times a week." And I said, "You did? Can I go with you?" She said, "Sure." So I went with her the next couple of days. We went to her water aerobics class and got in the pool with about 15 of her 80s and 90s year old youngster friends, and we did a 45-minute water aerobics class together. Mm-hmm. And it worked me out. But that was kind of a rarity. Most people, just again, they just were active, busy walkers, those kinds of things. But those are the top 3 or 4 that they attribute to their longevity.
Well, we will remind listeners that we are talking about the wisdom of centenarians, those who have lived to be 100 years old or older. And we're welcoming your questions for our guests. We're welcoming your own experiences. Perhaps you know someone who is 100 years old or older. What have you learned from him or her? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Steve Franklin is co-author of Celebrate 100, Centenarian Secrets to Success in Business and Life. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about what we can learn from centenarians with Steve Franklin, who is co-author of Celebrate 100. And we're welcoming your own wisdom, whether you're a centenarian or if you're getting there or if you know someone who has lived to be 100. What's the secret? What have you learned? What wisdom would you like to share with younger folks today? And our next caller is A.J. in Dousman. Hello, A.J.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Yes, go ahead.
I'm just a kid. I'm 67 years old. Mm-hmm. I have a couple years to go, but I have 2 grandmothers. I lived in their late 90s, and I still have an uncle that's almost 100. And what I've learned from them is how calm, cool, and collected they always are. It seems nothing bothers them, very relaxed attitudes. The other thing I want to say is I worked government canines my whole life, and I've regularly, for the last 30 years, gone to assisted living centers, Alzheimer's units, et cetera. And what I've found extraordinary is how the older generation remembers their dogs. People in Alzheimer's units can't remember their name, but they can tell me the name of their first dog. And I'm not sure, it's surreal just how many old people can't remember anything, but you show them a dog and they can tell you all about their dog and what their name is. And I find that just so very interesting. So I guess that's my comment.
Well, I'm glad you shared it. Thank you, AJ.
Yeah, and I experienced that too, Joy. And not the centenarians, interestingly, that I interviewed so much is some, we call them nonagenarians. A lot of people want me to start interviewing nonagenarians. I said, wow, that's too big. I got to stay with 100 plus. But that is a very common thing that you see. And even with some of the centenarians, they could remember, oh my goodness, they could remember the day of the week, the time of the day when certain things would happen, when they saw somebody had their first date, something like that. But again, they could remember what they can't remember what they did yesterday particularly, or they have to think a minute before it rolled back around to them or whatever. Of course, I'm only 66, and that happens to me already. But yes, they have an amazing long-term memory, and that's why I recommend to people start with childhood questions. When you're interviewing seniors, start with their childhood questions, because a lot of work's going on with dementia and Alzheimer's that I hope and pray that we find a cure for that in our lifetime. But start with those childhood questions, because that gets really the mind, believe it or not, warmed up. And I mean, and it's amazing what they, and then bring them forward. You know, so start saying, as a child, what's the first thing you remember about, you know, what your daddy or mama told you about money, or, and start way back then. And then if you look in the book, we take this, the questions progress with age. And so if you'll start with a few questions as a youth, bring them into school age and high school. And if they went to college, you know, fine. If not, as a young adult, then you can get pretty current on the questioning. It's just like warming up athletically. They will remember lots of stuff. Of course, I was interested mostly in asking a lot of questions about, you know, the Roaring Twenties, the 30s, the first and second World Wars, things they remembered. Although I did ask some questions like, you know, if I had the President of the United States here right in front of you, and you could give him one piece of advice, what would you give? And things like that. You know, how would you define today the word rich? And I would ask those questions oftentimes, that question in the middle of all the financial questions, thinking I might get some monetary answers. I got very few monetary answers. I would ask questions like, how do you want to be remembered? You know, when you are gone, how do you want your friends and family to remember you? So I did experience some of what JJ just commented on, but also I encourage people, start with youthful questions, take their memory way back, warm it up, and bring it forward, and you'll get just rich stories.
How did the centenarians that you interviewed feel about the changes that they have seen throughout their lives and the way the world has changed?
Well, they like it. They have pretty much a good love of life. They like the changes. I mean, they're amazed at some of the changes. You know, they've gone from, you know, buggy whips to space travel when you think about it in their lifetime. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, they have a love of life. They've got a great sense of humor, a healthy dose of self-esteem, and realistic attitude, positive but yet realistic attitude about life. So they enjoy it. And one of the questions I asked them, I said, during your lifetime, you've seen a lot of change. You've seen a lot of inventions made. What's the one invention that is the most positive impact on you? Mm-hmm. Now, guess what it was for women? It was different for women than men.
Oh, was it the microwave?
No, well, you're close. It was the washing machine.
Okay.
They said, man, when that washing machine came along, I had to quit. Yeah, I could quit, you know, using the washboard on those clothing. Man, mm-hmm. So for women, the big one was the washing machine and the vacuum cleaner.
And the guys wanted the guys like the TV, I bet.
Guys like telephone, TV, and of course you can imagine car. TV, yep. Telephone, and car. Those are the big three with the guys. So they like those changes, you know. And I had a number of them that started getting on the internet at age 90. You know, they got their first laptop or PC at 90. And
good for them.
They got on the internet. Walter Bruning had a blog right up to 114 plus. I mean, you can blog Walter daily, and you know, he just he'd tell you his advice about anything and everything, and he was very black and white about everything. So they like the world we live in. They do think, again, as I pointed out, they do think that they're concerned about the debt. They wish that our politicians could get together and talk better. They sense, as I think most of the media suggests, there's just acrimony in Washington. They, you know, that both the Democrats and Republicans and the Libertarians need to get together better. They're somewhat remorseful about that, you know, would like to see our political system, you know, be more cooperative and get along better. Interesting, a political thing. I was careful in asking political questions, but I asked them this, because I thought your listeners would be interested in. I said, during your lifetime, who was your favorite president and why?
FDR.
FDR, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, and why? He was by far number one. They said, well, he was a great communicator, and he gave us hope. I heard that. I heard those almost exact words multiple times. Guess who was number two?
Is it Obama or Reagan?
Nope. Reagan. You got it. Number two was Reagan. Great communicator and gave us hope. And that came from both Democrats and Republicans. You know, I mean, those whatever. And I've told people on a few shows I've been on. I said, look, if you're an aspiring presidential candidate, you better do two things in all your campaign. You better learn to be a very great communicator. You better give people hope. You can see President Obama, same thing. I mean, he was a fabulous communicator, you know, ran on hope and change, you know, whether you love him or hate him still. I mean, he's an example of that. So
That was one thing I thought was very insightful from their political perspective.
Let me get in Leslie from Washington Island. Hi, Leslie. You're on the air.
Hi. I am so glad that you're having this show. I am a nursing assistant, and I am all of 32. I have been doing my job since I was 19, and I have had so many people that were over 100 years old, and I just feel that they are the most versatile people, and people are afraid of the elderly, but they do have so much wisdom, and I just appreciate all of the wisdom that they give.
Yeah, and have you...
Thank you, Leslie, and you could not have said it better. You know, in our last chapter, we talk about the centenary spirit, and we talk about their remarkable ability to renegotiate life at every turn. You know, they have resilience, adaptability, willing to accept losses, changes that come with their aging, losing loved ones. A lot of them have buried their children.
Yeah.
A lot of them have buried their children. But they haven't let it stop them. You know, they're not quitters. They don't give up on life. The hard times, they cope well. And so, absolutely. And one of the things I'm trying to promote, Joy, is, you know, in our society, we're kind of a youth-crazed society. I mean, you see very few commercials on TV of real old people saying, isn't it wonderful? I mean, everybody looks like, you know, Barbie dolls and Kens, and they look gorgeous, and they're young, and we're all trying to look younger and wear stuff that makes us look younger and drive stuff that makes us look younger and eat stuff that's going to make us. And that's okay. I'm okay with that, you know. But I'm trying to bring a new respect and looking at our elders as opportunities for learning. Their library, each one of them is a library. I tell somebody, every time a centenarian dies, we've seen a library close. And you know, in other countries of the world, particularly over the Pacific Rim, you know, they look upon their elders with more reverence, with more opportunity to sit at their feet and learn, and with respect. And I think that the youth of our generation, and I'm including me in here with that, that we can learn so much from them if we will take the time to go and sit at their feet, ask a few questions, and just listen.
Do the centenarians, Steve Franklin, that you talk to, do they have regrets in common?
Very few. I asked that question. What regrets do you have? And there are only two that kind of popped up. They said, well, you know, I wish I had traveled a bit more, and I wish I had gotten a little more education. Those were the only two that really popped up. Was wish I traveled some more, and wish I got a little more education. So if your listeners are listening in, then just do a little more travel,
yeah.
See a little bit more of the world if you can, and get some more education. Not, it doesn't have to be formal education. You know, I tell everybody they're composite of the books they read, the people they meet, and the places they go. So enlarge your universe of books you read, people you meet, and places you go. Programs like this to listen to. And you won't maybe have those regrets.
Yeah, we have just a minute to go. What would you like the listeners to take away from this book or this conversation?
I would say three things. You know, financially, get out of debt, stay out of debt, pay cash, diversify your investments, work, find something that you love to do, give it all you got, and work as long as you can. And then finally, be a giver, not a taker. Be a giver, not a taker.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Joy, thank you for having me on your program. Hope you live long and live strong.
Thank you so much. Steve Franklin, co-author of Celebrate 100, Centenarian Secrets to Success in Business and Life. Thanks to Christy Taylor for producing and directing this program. Thanks to Bill Martins for on-air production. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There is much more to come. I also hope that you are with us at this time tomorrow. It's our week in review. We will have two guests from different political perspectives talking about the top state, national, and international news stories of the week. That's the week in review every Friday from 8 until 9. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.